2. It is considered to be true. 3. It tells how an institution came into existence. 4. In performing the ritual associated with the myth, one experiences knowledge of the origin and claims one's patriarchy. 5. Thus one lives the myth as a religion. My Random House Dictionary lists as its main heading for the Plymouth colonists not pilgrims, but Pilgrim Fathers. The Library of Congress similarly catalogs its holdings for Plymouth under Pilgrim Fathers, and of course, Fathers is capitalized, meaning fathers of our country, not of pilgrim children. Thanksgiving has thus moved from beyond history into the field of religion, civil religion, as Robert Bella has called it. To Bella, civil religions hold society together. Plymouth Rock achieved iconographic status around 1880 when some enterprising residents of the town rejoined its two pieces of the waterfront and built a Greek template around it. The template became a shrine, the Mayflower Compact became a sacred text, and our textbooks began to play the same function as the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, teaching us the meaning behind the civil rite of Thanksgiving. The religious character of pilgrim history shines forth in an introduction by Valerian Paget to William Bradford's famous chronicle of Plymouth Plantation. The eyes of Europe were upon this little English handful of unconscious heroes and saints, taking courage from them step by step. For their children's children, the same ideals of freedom burned so clear and strong that the little episode we have just been contemplating resulted in the birth of the United States of America, and, above all, of the establishment of the humanitarian ideals it typifies, and for which the pilgrims offered their sacrifice upon the altar of the sonship of man. In this invocation, the pilgrims supply not only the origin of the United States, but also the inspiration for democracy in Europe, and perhaps for all goodness in the world today. I suspect that the original colonists, separatists, and Anglicans alike would have been amused. The civil ritual we practice marginalizes Indians. Our archetypal image of the first Thanksgiving portrays the groaning boards in the woods with the pilgrims in their starched Sunday best next to their almost naked Indian guests. As a holiday greeting card puts it, "I is for the Indians we invited to share our food." The silliness of all this reaches its zenith in the handouts that schoolchildren have carried home for decades, complete with captions such as, "They served pumpkins and turkeys and corn and squash. The Indians had never seen such a feast." When the Native American novelist Michael Doris's son brought home this information from his New Hampshire elementary school, Doris pointed out that the pilgrims had literally never seen such a feast, since all foods mentioned are exclusively indigenous to the Americas and had been provided by, or with the aid of, the local tribe. This notion that we advanced peoples provided for the Indians, exactly the converse of the truth, is not benign. It reemerges time and again in our history to complicate race relations. For example, we are told that white plantation owners furnished food and medical care for their slaves, yet every shred of food, shelter, and clothing on the plantations was raised, built, woven, or paid for by black labor. Today, Americans believe, as part of our political understanding of the world, that we are the most generous nation on earth in terms of foreign aid, overlooking the fact that the net dollar flow from almost every third world nation runs toward the United States. The true history of Thanksgiving reveals embarrassing facts. The pilgrims didn't introduce the tradition. Eastern Indians had observed autumnal harvest celebrations for centuries. Although George Washington did set aside days for national Thanksgiving, our modern celebrations date back only to 1863. During the Civil War, when the Union needed all the patriotism that such an observance might muster, Abraham Lincoln proclaimed Thanksgiving a national holiday. The Pilgrims had nothing to do with it. Not until the 1890s did they even get included in the tradition. For that matter, no one used the term Pilgrims until the 1870s. The ideological meaning American history has ascribed to Thanksgiving compounds the embarrassment. The Thanksgiving legend makes Americans ethnocentric. After all, if our culture has God on its side, why should we consider other cultures seriously? This ethnocentrism intensified in the middle of the last century. In Race and Manifest Destiny, Reginald Horseman has shown how the idea of God on our side was used to legitimate the open expression of Anglo-Saxon superiority vis-a-vis Mexicans, Native Americans, peoples of the Pacific, Jews, and even Catholics. Today, when textbooks promote this ethnocentrism with their pilgrim stories, they leave students less able to learn from and deal with people from other cultures. On occasion, we pay a more direct cost. Censorship. In 1970, for example, the Massachusetts Department of Commerce asked the Wampanoags to select a speaker to mark the 350th anniversary of the Pilgrims' Landing. Frank James was selected, but first he had to show a copy of his speech to the white people in charge of the ceremony. When they saw what he had written, they would not allow him to read it. James had written, "Today is a time of celebrating for you, but it is not a time of celebrating for me. It is with heavy heart that I look back upon what happened to my people. The Pilgrims had hardly explored the shores of Cape Cod 4 days before they had robbed the graves of my ancestors and stolen their corn, wheat, and beans." Massasoit, the great leader of the Wampanoag, knew these facts, yet he and his people welcomed and befriended the settlers. Little knowing that before 50 years were to pass, the Wampanoags and other Indians living near the settlers would be killed by their guns or dead from diseases that we caught from them. Although our way of life is almost gone and our language is almost extinct, we, the Wampanoags, still walk the lands of Massachusetts. What has happened cannot be changed. But today we work toward a better America, a more Indian America, where people and nature, once again, are important. What the Massachusetts Department of Commerce censored was not some incendiary falsehood, but historical truth. Nothing James would have said, had he been allowed to speak, was false, excepting the word wheat. Our textbooks also omit the facts about grave robbing, Indian enslavement, the plague, and so on, even though they were common knowledge in colonial New England. For at least a century, Puritan ministers thundered their interpretation of the meaning of the plague from the New England pulpits. Thus, our popular history of the Pilgrims has not been a process of gaining perspective, but of deliberate forgetting. Instead of these important facts, textbooks supply the feel-good minutiae of Squanto's helpfulness, his name, the fish in the corn hills, sometimes even the menu, and the number of Indians who attended the prototypical first Thanksgiving. I have focused here on untoward detail only because our histories have suppressed everything awkward for so long. The Pilgrims' courage in setting forth in the late fall to make their way on a continent new to them remains unsurpassed. In their first year, the Pilgrims, like the Indians, suffered from diseases, including scurvy and pneumonia. Half of them died. It wasn't immoral of the Pilgrims to have taken over Pawtuxet. They didn't cause the plague, and they were as baffled as to its origin as the stricken Indian villagers. Massasoit was happy that the Pilgrims were using the bay, for the Pawtuxet, being dead, had no more need for the site. Pilgrim-Indian relations started reasonably positively. Plymouth, unlike many other colonies, usually paid the Indians for the land it took. In some instances, Europeans settled in Indian towns because Indians had invited them, as protection against another tribe or a nearby competing European power. In some, U.S. history is no more violent and oppressive than the histories of England, Russia, Indonesia, or Burundi. But neither is it exceptionally less violent. The antidote to feel-good history is not feel-bad history, but honest and inclusive history. If textbook authors feel compelled to give moral instruction, the way origin myths have always done, they could accomplish this aim by allowing students to learn both the good and the bad side of the pilgrim tale. Conflict would then become part of the story, and students might discover that the knowledge they gain has implications for their lives today. Correctly taught, the issues of the era of the first Thanksgiving could help Americans grow more thoughtful and more tolerant, rather than more ethnocentric. Origin myths don't come cheaply. To glorify the pilgrims is dangerous. The genial omissions and the invented details with which our textbooks retail the pilgrim archetype are close cousins of the overt censorship practiced by the Massachusetts Department of Commerce in denying Frank James the right to speak. Surely, in history, truth should be held sacred at whatever cost. Chapter 4. Red Eyes. To understand the making of Anglo-America is impossible without close and sustained attention to its indigenous predecessors, allies, and nemeses. James Axtell. The invaders also anticipated, correctly, that other Europeans would question the morality of their enterprise. They therefore prepared quantities of propaganda to overpower their own countrymen's scruples. The propaganda gradually took standard form as an ideology with conventional assumptions and semantics. We live with it still. Francis Jennings. Memory says, I did that. Pride replies, I could not have done that. Eventually, memory yields. Friedrich Nietzsche. There is not one Indian in the whole of this country who does not cringe in anguish and frustration because of these textbooks. There is not one Indian child who has not come home in shame and tears. Rupert Custo. Historically, American Indians have been the most lied about subset of our population. That's why Michael Doris said that, in learning about Native Americans, one does not start from point zero, but from minus 10. High school students start below zero because of their textbooks, which unapologetically present Native Americans through white eyes. Today's textbooks should do better, especially since what historians call Indian history, though really it is interracial, has flowered in the last 20 years. And the information on which new textbooks might be based currently rests on library shelves. There has been some improvement in textbooks' treatment of Native peoples in recent years. In 1961, the best-selling Rise of the American Nation contained 10 illustrations featuring Native people, alone or with whites, of 268 illustrations. Most of these pictures focused on themes of primitive life and savage warfare. 25 years later, the retitled Triumph of the American Nation contained 15 illustrations of Indians. More important, no longer were Native Americans depicted as one-dimensional primitives. Rather, they were people who participated in struggles to preserve their identities and their land. Included were Metacomet, King Philip, Crispus Attucks, first casualty of the Revolution, who was also part black in ancestry, Sequoia, who invented the Cherokee alphabet, and Navajo code talkers in World War II. Nevertheless, the authors of American history textbooks need a crash course in cultural relativism and ethnic sensitivity, according to James Axtell, who criticized textbooks in 1987 for still using such terms as half-breed, massacre, and war whooping. Reserving milder terms such as frontier initiative and settlers for whites is equally biased. Even worse are the author's overall interpretations, which continue to be shackled by the conventional assumptions and semantics that have explained Indian-white relations for centuries. Textbook authors still write history to comfort descendants of the settlers. Our journey into the history of Indian peoples and their relations with European and African invaders cannot be a happy excursion. Native Americans are not, and must not, be props in a sort of theme park of the past, where we go to have a good time and see exotic cultures. What we have done to the peoples who were living in North America is, according to anthropologist Saul Tax, our original sin. If we look Indian history squarely in the eye, we are going to get red eyes. This is our past, however, and we must acknowledge it. It's time for textbooks to send white children home, if not with red eyes, at least with thought-provoking questions. Today's textbooks at least try to be accurate about Indian culture. All but two of the 12 textbooks I surveyed begin by devoting more than 5 pages to pre-contact Native societies. And, to their credit, most of the textbooks recognize diversity among Native societies. They tell about the League of Five Nations among the Iroquois in the Northeast, potlatches among the northwestern coastal Indians, cliff dwellings in the Southwest, and caste divisions among the Natchez in the Southeast. In the process of presenting 10 or 20 different cultures in 6 or 8 pages, however, the textbooks can hardly reach a high level of sophistication. So, they seize upon the unusual. No matter that the Choctaws were more numerous and played a much larger role in American history than the Natchez, they were also more ordinary. Students will not find among the Native Americans portrayed in their history textbooks many regular folks with whom they might identify. American Indian societies pose a special problem for textbooks. The authors of history textbooks are consumers, not practitioners, of archaeology, ethnobotany, linguistics, physical anthropology, folklore studies, cultural anthropology, ethnohistory, and other related disciplines. Scholars in these fields can tell us much, albeit tentatively, about what happened in the Americas before Europeans and Africans arrived. Unfortunately, the authors of history textbooks treat archaeology et al. As dead disciplines to be mined for answers. These fields study dead people, to be sure, but they are alive with controversy. Only the American adventure admits uncertainty. This page may be out of date by the time it is read. Adventure goes on to present claims that humans have been in the Americas for 12,000, 21,000, and 40,000 years. As a result, although Adventure is one of the oldest of the 12 textbooks, its pre-Columbian pages have not gone out of date. Most other textbooks retain their usual authoritative tone. On the matter of the first human settlement of the Americas, estimates vary from 12,000 years before the present to more than 70,000 BP. Some scientists believe that the original settlers came in successive waves over thousands of years. Genetic similarities convince others that most natives descended from a single small band. The majority of the textbooks choose one position or the other and present it as undisputed fact. Every textbook says something like this, from American History. The water level of the oceans dropped sharply, exposing a land bridge between Asia and North America. Actually, while most scholars accept a Beringia crossing, actual evidence is slim, so we cannot rule out boat crossings, accidental or purposeful. Even if the first Americans arrived on foot, they were just as surely explorers as Columbus. Nonetheless, textbooks picture them as primitives, vaguely Neanderthalian. This archetype of the primitive savage, not very bright, enmeshed in wars with nature and other humans, drive some of the certainties that textbooks impose on the ancient past. American history tells of the wanderers who moved slowly southward and to the east. Many thousand years passed before they had spread over all of North and South America. Actually, a significant number of archaeologists believe that people reached most parts of the Americas within 1,000 years, too rapidly to allow easy archaeological determination of the direction and timing of their migration. They didn't know that they were exploring a new continent, American history goes on, offering no evidence upon which to infer these early Americans' alleged ignorance. The depiction of mental torpor persists as American history continues. None of the groups made much progress in developing simple machines or substituting mechanical or even animal power for their own muscle power. In Europe and Asia, most pre-1492 machines depended on horses, oxen, water buffalo, mules, or cattle, beasts that were unknown in the Americas, after all. American history then generalizes. Those who planted seeds and cultivated the land, instead of merely hunting and gathering food, were more secure and comfortable. Apparently, the author has not encountered the affluent primitive theory, which persuaded anthropology some 25 years ago that gatherer-hunters lived quite comfortably. American history completes the evolutionary stereotype. These agricultural people were mostly peaceful, though they could fight fiercely to protect their fields. The hunters and wanderers, on the other hand, were quite warlike because their need to move about brought them frequently into conflict with other groups. Here the author betrays the influence of the old savage to barbaric to civilized school dating back to L.H. Morgan and Karl Marx in the last century. The authors of history textbooks may well have encountered such thinking in anthropology courses when they were undergraduates. It is no longer taught today, however. Decades ago, most anthropologists challenged the outmoded continuum, determining that hunters and gatherers were relatively peaceful compared to agriculturalists, and that modern societies were more warlike still. Thus, violence increases with civilization. Today's textbooks do confer civilization on some natives. Like the Spanish conquistadors themselves, the American adventure equates wealth and civilization. Unlike the non-civilized peoples of the Caribbean, the Aztec were rich and prosperous. Textbooks invariably put civilization far away, in Mexico, Guatemala, or Peru. By comparison, Indian life in North America was less advanced, says the American pageant. It seems that, despite good intentions, textbooks cannot resist contrasting primitive Americans with modern Europeans. Part of the problem is that the books are really comparing rural America to urban Europe, Massachusetts to London. Comparing Tenochtitlan, now Mexico City, to rural Scotland might produce a very different impression. For when Cortes arrived, Tenochtitlan was a city of 100,000 to 300,000, whose central market was so busy and noisy that it could be heard more than 4 miles away, according to Bernal Diaz, who accompanied him. Moreover, from the perspective of the average inhabitant, life may have been equally as advanced and pleasant in Massachusetts or Scotland as in Aztec Mexico or London. For a long time, Native Americans have been rebuking textbook authors for reserving the adjective civilized for European cultures. In 1927, an organization of Native leaders called the Grand Council Fire of American Indians criticized textbooks as unjust to the life of our people. They went on to ask, "What is civilization? Its marks are a noble religion and philosophy, original arts, stirring music, rich story and legend. We had these. Then we were not savages, but a civilized race." Even an appreciative treatment of native cultures reinforces ethnocentrism so long as it does not challenge the primitive to civilized continuum. This continuum inevitably conflates the meaning of civilized in everyday conversation, refined or enlightened, with having a complex division of labor, the only definition that anthropologists defend. When we consider the continuum carefully, it immediately becomes problematic. Was the Third Reich civilized, for instance? Most anthropologists would answer yes. In what ways do we prefer the civilized Third Reich to the more primitive Arawak nation that Columbus encountered? If we refuse to label the Third Reich civilized, are we not using the term to imply a certain comity? If so, we must consider the Arawaks civilized, and we must also consider Columbus and his Spaniards primitive, if not savage. Ironically, societies characterized by a complex division of labor are often marked by inequality and capable of supporting large specialized armies. Precisely these civilized societies are likely to resort to savage violence in their attempts to conquer primitive societies. Thoughtless use of the otherizing terms, civilized and civilization, blocks any real inquiry into the worldview or social structure of the uncivilized person or society. In 1990, President Bush condemned Iraq's invasion of Kuwait with the words, "The entire civilized world is against Iraq," an irony in that Iraq's Tigris and Euphrates valleys are the earliest known seat of civilization. After contact with Europeans and Africans, Indian societies changed rapidly. Native Americans took into their cultures not only guns, blankets, and kettles, but also new foods, ways of building houses, and ideas from Christianity. Most American history textbooks tell about the changes in only one group, the Plains Indians. 8 of the 12 textbooks I surveyed mention the rapid efflorescence of this colorful culture after the Spaniards introduced the horse to the American West. It is an exhilarating example of syncretism, blending elements of two different cultures to create something new. The transformation in the Plains cultures, however, was only the tip of the cultural change iceberg. An even more profound metamorphosis occurred as Europeans linked native peoples to the developing world economy. Yet textbooks make no mention of this process, despite the fact that it continues to affect formerly independent cultures in the last half of our century. In the early 1970s, for example, Lapps in Norway replaced their sled dogs with snowmobiles, only to find themselves vulnerable to Arab oil embargoes. The process seems inevitable, hence perhaps is neither to be praised nor decried, but it shouldn't be ignored, because it is crucial to understanding how Europeans took over America. In Atlantic North America, members of Indian nations possessed a variety of sophisticated skills, from the ability to weave watertight baskets to an understanding of how certain plants can be used to reduce pain. At first, Native Americans traded corn, beaver, fish, sassafras, and other goods with the French, Dutch, and British in return for axes, blankets, cloth, beads, and kettles. Soon, however, Europeans persuaded natives to specialize in the fur and slave trades. Native Americans were better hunters and trappers than Europeans, and with the guns the Europeans sold them, they became better still. Other native skills began to atrophy. Why spend hours making a watertight basket when in one-tenth the time you could trap enough beavers to trade for a kettle? Even agriculture, which the Native Americans had shown to the Europeans, declined because it became easier to trade for food than to grow it. Everyone acted in rational self-interest in joining such a system. That is, Native Americans were not mere victims, because everyone's standard of living improved, at least in theory. Some of the rapid changes in Eastern Indian societies exemplify syncretism. When the Iroquois combined European guns and Native American tactics to smash the Hurons, they controlled their own culture and chose which elements of European culture to incorporate, which to modify, which to ignore. Native Americans learned how to repair guns, cast bullets, build stronger forts, and fight to annihilate. Native Americans also became well known as linguists, often speaking two European languages, French, English, Dutch, or Spanish, and at least two Indian languages. British colonists sometimes used natives as interpreters when dealing with the Spanish or French, not just with other Native American nations. These developments were not all matters of happy economics and voluntary syncretic cultural transformation, however. Natives were operating under a military and cultural threat, and they knew it. They quickly deduced that European guns were more efficient than their bows and arrows. Europeans soon realized that trade goods could be used to win and maintain political alliances with Indian nations. To deal with the new threat, and because whites demanded institutions reflective of their own with which to relate, many native groups strengthened their tribal governments. Chiefs acquired power they had never had before. These governments often ruled unprecedentedly broad areas. Because the heightened warfare and the plagues had wiped out smaller tribes or caused them to merge with larger ones for protection. Large nations became ethnic melting pots, taking in whites and blacks as well as other Indians. New confederations and nations developed, such as the Creeks, Seminoles, and Lumbees. The tribes also became more male-dominated. In imitation of Europeans, or because of the expanded importance of war skills in their cultures. Tribes that were closest to the Europeans got guns first, guns that could be trained on interior peoples who had not yet acquired any. Suddenly, some nations had a great military advantage over others. The result was an escalation of Indian warfare. Native nations had engaged in conflict before Europeans came, of course. Tribes rarely fought to the finish, however. Some tribes didn't want to take over the lands belonging to other nations, partly because each had its own sacred sites. For a nation to exterminate its neighbors was difficult anyway, since all enjoyed the same level of military technology. Now, all this changed. European powers deliberately increased Indian warfare by playing one nation off against another. The Spanish, for example, used a divide-and-conquer strategy to defeat the Aztecs in Mexico. In Scotland and Ireland, the English had played tribes against one another to extend British rule. Now they did the same in North America. For many tribes, the motive for the increased combat was the enslavement of other Indians to sell to the Europeans for more guns and kettles. As northern tribes specialized in fur, certain southern tribes specialized in people. Some Native Americans had enslaved each other long before Europeans arrived. Now Europeans vastly expanded Indian slavery. Colonists in South Carolina paid nearby Indian nations in guns, ammunition, or other goods, which enabled them to enslave interior nations as far west as Arkansas. I had expected to find in our textbooks the cliché that Native Americans did not make good slaves, but only two books, Triumph of the American Nation and The American Tradition, say even that. The American Pageant contains a paragraph that at least states the basics. Indian slaves were among the colony's earliest exports, even if it gives no hint of the trade's extent. American history buries a sentence, "A few Indians were enslaved," in its discussion of the African slave trade. Otherwise, the 12 textbooks are silent on the subject of the Native American slave trade. The Europeans' enslavement of Native Americans has a long history. Textbooks used in elementary schools tell that Ponce de Leon went to Florida to seek the mythical Fountain of Youth. They don't say that his main business was to capture slaves for Hispaniola. In New England, Indian slavery led directly to African slavery. The first blacks imported there in 1638 were brought from the West Indies to be exchanged for Native Americans from Connecticut. On the eve of the New York City Slave Rebellion of 1712, in which Native and African slaves united, about one resident in four was enslaved, and one slave in four was Indian. A 1730 census of South Kingston, Rhode Island, showed 935 whites, 333 African slaves, and 223 Native American slaves. The center of Native American slavery, like African American slavery, was South Carolina. Its population in 1708 included 3,960 free whites, 4,100 African slaves, 1,400 Indian slaves, and 120 indentured servants, presumably white. These numbers don't reflect the magnitude of Native slavery, however, because they omit the export trade. From Carolina, as from New England, colonists sent Indian slaves, who might escape, to the West Indies, where they could never escape, in exchange for black slaves. Charleston shipped more than 10,000 natives in chains to the West Indies in 1 year. Further west, so many Pawnee Indians were sold to whites that Pawnee became the name applied in the plains to all slaves, whether they were of Indian or African origin. On the West Coast, Pearson Redding, a manager of John Sitter's huge grant of Indian land in Central California, extolled the easy life he led in 1844. "The Indians of California make as obedient and humble slaves as the Negro in the South." In the Southwest, whites enslaved Navajos and Apaches right up to the middle of the Civil War. Intensified warfare and the slave trade rendered stable settlements no longer safe, helping to de-agriculturalize Native Americans. To avoid being targets for capture, Indians abandoned their cornfields and their villages and began to live in smaller settlements from which they could more easily escape to the woods. Ultimately, they had to trade with Europeans even for food. As Europeans learned from natives what to grow and how to grow it, they became less dependent upon Indians and Indian technology, while Indians became more dependent upon Europeans and European technology. Thus, what worked for the Native Americans in the short run worked against them in the long run. In the long run, it was Indians who were enslaved, Indians who died, Indian technology that was lost, Indian cultures that fell apart. By the time the pitiful remnant of the Massachusetts tribe converted to Christianity and joined the Puritans praying Indian towns, they did so in response to an invading culture that told them their religion was wrong and Christianity was right. This process exemplifies what anthropologists call cultural imperialism. Even the proud Plains Indians, whose syncretic culture combined horses and guns from the Spanish with native art, religion, and hunting styles, showed the effects of cultural imperialism. The Sioux word for white man, Wasichu, meant one who has everything good. To be anthropologically literate about culture contact, students should be familiar with the terms syncretism and cultural imperialism, or at least the concepts they denote. None of the 12 textbooks mentions either term, and most of them explain nothing of the process of cultural change, again except for the Plains Indian horse culture, which, as a consequence, comes across as unique. Not one textbook tells of the process of incorporation into the global economy. None tells how contact worked to de-skill Native Americans. Most don't tell of increased Indian warfare. And only the American pageant even hints at the extent of the Native American slave trade. Just as American societies changed when they encountered whites, so European societies changed when they encountered natives. textbooks completely miss this side of the mutual accommodation and acculturation process. Instead, their view of white Indian relations is dominated by the archetype of the frontier line. Textbooks present the process as a moving line of white and black settlement, Indians on one side, whites and blacks on the other. Pocahontas and Squanto aside, the natives and Europeans don't meet much in textbook history, except as whites remove Indians further west. In reality, whites and Native Americans worked together, sometimes lived together, and quarreled with each other for scores and even hundreds of years. For 325 years, after all, from the first permanent Spanish settlement in 1565 to the end of the Sioux and Apache autonomy around 1890, independent Native and European nations coexisted in what is now the United States. The term frontier hardly does justice to this process, for it implies a line or boundary. Contact, not separation, was the rule. Frontier also locates the observer somewhere in the urban East, from which the frontier is out there. Textbook authors seem not to have encountered the trick question, which came first, civilization or the wilderness? The answer is civilization, for only the civilized mind could define the world of native farmers, fishers, and gatherers and hunters coexisting with forests, crops, and animals as a wilderness. Calling the area beyond secure European control frontier or wilderness makes it subtly alien. Such a viewpoint is intrinsically Eurocentric and marginalizes the actions of non-urban people, both native and non-native. The band of interaction was amazingly multicultural. In 1635, 16 different languages could be heard among the settlers in New Amsterdam. Languages from North America, Africa, and Europe. In 1794, when the zone of contact had reached the eastern Midwest, a single northern town, the Glades, was made up of hundreds of Shawnee, Miami, and Delaware Indians, British and French traders and artisans, several Nanticokes, Cherokees, and Iroquois, a few African-American and white American captives, and whites who had married into or been adopted by Indian families. The Glades was truly multicultural in its holidays, observing Mardi Gras, St. Patrick's Day, the birthday of the British Queen, and Indian celebrations. In 1835, when the contact area was near the West Coast, John Sutter, with permission of the Mexican authorities, recruited Native Americans to raise his wheat crop, operate a distillery, a hat factory, and a blanket company, and build a fort, now Sacramento. Procuring uniforms from Russian traders and officers from Europe, Sutter organized a 200-man Indian army, clothed in Tsarist uniforms and commanded in German. Our history textbooks still obliterate the interracial, multicultural nature of frontier life. American history devotes almost a page to Sutter's fort without ever hinting that Native Americans were anything other than enemies. Gradually, he built a fortified town, which he called Sutter's Fort. The entire place was surrounded by a thick wall 18 feet high, about 6 meters, topped with cannon for protection against unfriendly Indians. The historian Gary Nash tells us that interculturation took place from the start in Virginia, facilitated by the fact that some Indians lived among the English as day laborers, while a number of settlers fled to Indian villages rather than endure the rigors of life among the autocratic English. Indeed, many white and black newcomers chose to live an Indian lifestyle. In his Letters from an American Farmer, Michel Guillaume Jean de Crèvecoeur wrote, "There must be in the Indian social bond something singularly captivating and far superior to be boasted of among us, for thousands of Europeans are Indians, and we have no examples of even one of those aborigines having from choice become Europeans." Crèvecoeur overstated his case, as we know from Squanto's example. Some natives chose to live among whites from the beginning. The migration was mostly the other way, however. As Benjamin Franklin put it, "No European who has tasted savage life can afterwards bear to live in our societies." Europeans were always trying to stop the outflow. Hernando de Soto had to post guards to keep his men and women from defecting to native societies. The pilgrims so feared Indianization that they made it a crime for men to wear long hair. People who did run away to the Indians might expect very extreme punishments, even up to the death penalty, if caught by whites. Nonetheless, right up to the end of independent Indian nationhood in 1890, whites continued to defect, and whites who lived an Indian lifestyle, such as Daniel Boone, became cultural heroes in white society. Communist Eastern Europe erected an iron curtain to stop its outflow, but could never explain why, if communist societies were the most progressive on earth, they had to prevent people from defecting. American colonial embarrassment similarly went straight to the heart of their ideology, also an ideology of progress. Textbooks in Eastern Europe and the United States have handled the problem in the same way, by omitting the facts. Not one American history textbook mentions the attraction of native societies to European Americans and African Americans. African Americans frequently fled to Indian societies to escape bondage. What did whites find so alluring? According to Benjamin Franklin, all their government is by counsel of the sages. There is no force. There are no prisons. No officers to compel obedience or inflict punishment. Probably foremost, the lack of hierarchy in the native societies in the eastern United States attracted the admiration of European observers. Frontiersmen were taken with the extent to which Native Americans enjoyed freedom as individuals. Women were also accorded more status and power in most native societies than in white societies of the time, which white women noted with envy in captivity narratives. Although leadership was substantially hereditary in some nations, most Indian societies north of Mexico were much more democratic than Spain, France, or even England in the 17th and 18th centuries. There is not a man in the ministry of the Five Nations who has gained his office otherwise than by merit, waxed Lieutenant Governor Cadwallader Colden of New York in 1727. Their authority is only the esteem of the people, and ceases the moment that esteem is lost. Colden applied to the Iroquois terms redolent of the natural rights of mankind. Here we see the natural origin of all power and authority among a free people. Indeed, Native American ideas may be partly responsible for our democratic institutions. We have seen how Native ideas of liberty, fraternity, and equality found their way to Europe to influence social philosophers such as Thomas More, Locke, Montaigne, Montesquieu, and Rousseau. These European thinkers then influenced Americans such as Franklin, Jefferson, and Madison. In recent years, historians have debated whether Indian ideas may also have influenced our democracy more directly. Through 150 years of colonial contact, the Iroquois League stood before the colonies as an object lesson in how to govern a large domain democratically. The terms used by Lieutenant Governor Colden find an echo in our Declaration of Independence 50 years later. In the 1740s, the Iroquois wearied of dealing with several often bickering English colonies and suggested that the colonies form a union similar to the League. In 1754, Benjamin Franklin, who had spent much time among the Iroquois observing their deliberations, pleaded with colonial leaders to consider the Albany Plan of Union. It would be a strange thing if six nations of ignorant savages should be capable of forming a scheme for such a union, and be able to execute it in such a manner as that it has subsisted ages and appears insoluble, and yet that a like union should be impracticable for 10 or 12 English colonies. The colonies rejected the plan. but it was a forerunner of the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution. Both the Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention referred openly to Iroquois ideas and imagery. In 1775, Congress formulated a speech to the Iroquois, signed by John Hancock, that quoted Iroquois advice from 1744. "The Six Nations are a wise people," Congress wrote. "Let us hearken to their counsel and teach our children to follow it." John Mohawk has argued that the American Indians are directly or indirectly responsible for the public meeting tradition, free speech, democracy, and all those things which got attached to the Bill of Rights. Without the native example, do you really believe that all those ideas would have found birth among a people who had spent a millennium butchering other people because of intolerance of questions of religion? Mohawk may have overstated the case for native democracy, since heredity played a major role in office holding in many Indian societies. His case is strengthened, however, by the fact that wherever Europeans went in the Americas, they projected monarchs, King Philip, or other undemocratic leaders onto native societies. To some degree, this projecting was done out of European self-interest, so they could claim to have purchased tribal land as a result of dealing with one person or faction. The practice also betrayed habitual European thought. Europeans could not believe that nations did not have such rulers, since that was the only form of government they knew. For 100 years after our Revolution, Americans credited Native Americans as a source of their democratic institutions. Revolutionary-era cartoonists used images of Indians to represent the colonies against Britain. Virginia's Patriot Rifle Companies wore Indian clothes and moccasins as they fought the Redcoats. When colonists took action to oppose unjust authority, as in the Boston Tea Party, or the anti-rent protests against Dutch plantations in the Hudson River Valley during the 1840s, they chose to dress as Indians. Not to blame Indians for the demonstrations, but to appropriate a symbol identified with liberty. Of course, Dutch traditions influenced Plymouth as well as New York. So did British common law and the Magna Carta. American democracy seems to be another example of syncretism, combining ideas from Europe and Native America. The degree of Native influence is hard to specify, since that influence came through several sources. Textbooks might present it as a soft hypothesis rather than hard fact, but they should not leave it out. In the 12 textbooks I surveyed, discussion of any intellectual influence of Native Americans on European Americans was limited to Discovering American History, which pictures a wampum belt paired with Benjamin Franklin's famous cartoon of a divided, hence dying, snake. Franklin's Albany plan might have been inspired by the Iroquois League, captions Discovering. The wampum belt expresses the unity of tribes achieved through the League. Compare it with Franklin's cartoon. The other 11 books are silent. But then, the books leave out most contributions of Native Americans to the modern world. I had expected to find at least such non-controversial items as food, words, and place names. After all, our regional cuisines, the dishes that make American food distinctive, often combine Indian with European and African elements. Examples range from New England pork and beans to New Orleans gumbo to Texas chili. Mutual acculturation between Native and African Americans, due to shared experience in slavery as well as escapes by blacks to Native communities, accounts for soul food being part Indian, from cornbread and grits to greens and hush puppies. Historians have known for centuries that Indians of the Americas domesticated more than half of the food crops now grown around the world. Native place names dot our landscape, from Okefenokee to Alaska. Even 19th century racists relished names like Mississippi, meaning Great River, from Hurricane to Skunk to, probably, OK, Indian words have been incorporated into English. Notwithstanding all this, only Land of Promise and Triumph of the American Nation discuss Indian foods. Only Triumph mentions Indian names, and none of the 12 books deals with Indian words. Transmitting food and names, mundane though it may seem, involves ideas. Native farming methods were not primitive. Indian farmers in some tribes drew 2 or 3 times as much nourishment from the soil as we do. Place names, too, show intellectual interchange. Whites had to be asking Indians, "Where am I? What is this place called? What is that animal? What is the name of that mountain?" Although textbooks appreciate native cultures, the possibility of real interculturation, especially in matters of the intellect, is foreign to them. This is a shame, for authors thereby ignore much of what has made America distinctive from Europe. In a travel narrative, Peter Kalm wrote in 1750, "The French, English, Germans, Dutch, and other Europeans, who have lived for several years in distant provinces near and among the Indians, grow so like them in their behavior and thought that they can only be distinguished by the difference of their color." In the famous essay, "The Frontier in American History," Frederick Jackson Turner told how the frontier masters the European, strips off the garments of civilization, and requires him to be an Indian in thought as well as dress. Before long, he has gone to planting Indian corn and plowing with a sharp stick. Gradually, he builds something new, but the outcome is not the old Europe. It is syncretic. It is American. Acknowledging how aboriginal we are culturally, how the United States and Europe, too, have been influenced by Native American, as well as European ideas, would require significant textbook rewriting. If we recognized American Indians as important intellectual antecedents of our political structure, we would have to acknowledge that acculturation has been a two-way street, and we might have to reassess the assumption of primitive Indian culture that legitimates the entire conquest. In 1970, the Indian Historian Press produced a critique of our histories, Textbooks and the American Indian. One of the press's yardsticks for evaluating books was the question, "Does the textbook describe the religions, philosophies, and contributions to thought of the American Indian?" A quarter century later, the answer must still be no. Consider how textbooks treat Native religions as a unitary whole. The American Way describes Native American religion in these words: "These Native Americans, in the Southeast, believed that nature was filled with spirits. Each form of life, such as plants and animals, had a spirit. Earth and air held spirits, too. People were never alone. They shared their lives with the spirits of nature." Way is trying to show respect for Native American religion, but it doesn't work. Stated flatly like this, the beliefs seem like make-believe, not the sophisticated theology of a higher civilization. Let's try a similarly succinct summary of the beliefs of many Christians today. "These Americans believed that one great male God ruled the world. Sometimes they divided him into 3 parts, which they called Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. They ate crackers and wine or grape juice, believing they were eating the Son's body and drinking his blood. If they believed strongly enough, they would live on forever after they died." Textbooks never describe Christianity this way. It's offensive. Believers would immediately argue that such a description fails to convey the symbolic meaning or spiritual satisfaction of communion. Textbooks could present American Indian religions from a perspective that takes them seriously as attractive and persuasive belief systems. The anthropologist Frederick Turner has pointed out that when whites remark upon the fact that Indians perceive a spirit in every animal or rock, they are simultaneously admitting their own loss of a deep spiritual relationship with the earth. Native Americans are part of the total living universe, wrote Turner. Spiritual health is to be had only by accepting this condition and by attempting to live in accordance with it. Turner contends that this life view is healthier than European alternatives. Ours is a shockingly dead view of creation. We ourselves are the only